Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Monica Attard. Well, the US midterms are now history, and we all know now that the red wave didn't arrive and we didn't see a blue wave driven by outrage at the Supreme Court's move to overturn almost 50 years of a woman's right to choose. While the Republicans have now flipped the House, they failed to gain the Senate. Normal political cycles in the US would have tipped a big win for the Republicans. Then add an unpopular president in the White House, and the cost of living pressures to the mix, and at best the midterms were a status quo result for the Republicans. A less charitable reading was that it was a disaster. Why did the red wave fail to materialise? Does the result herald the end of Donald Trump? And has the partisan media in America actually lost its bite? And while we're at it, is Elon Musk a disruptor in this space, social media, or just a naughty boy? And what about this new kid on the block, Semaphore, a new way of doing international journalism? To discuss all of this and more, I'm joined by Ben Smith, American journalist and editor-in-chief of Semaphore, a global news organization. Previously, Ben was a media columnist for the New York Times and editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed News. So, Ben Smith, thank you very, very much for joining us here on Fourth Estate. Let's jump straight in to a fascinating story globally at the moment, which is American politics and the midterms that you've just been through over there. Many predicted a Republican win. Do you think media and the polls got it wrong? What happened there?
The polls mostly got it right. The polls suggested a very close election in which that would produce a tight split. Media, we've had a few years of the polls getting it wrong. And so media assumed the polls got it wrong again in favor of the Democrats. And it's actually in some ways the problem with journalism that is based on polls and then a layer of journalists' guesses about the polls. Mm.
I think journalists failure as well.
Yeah. So I think the vibes-based consensus was that the Democrats were going to lose, and was incorrect.
And did it catch you by surprise?
Yeah, we all live in, this is the thing about politics, right? We all sort of live in the same bubble of conventional wisdom and expectations, and it caught the Democrats by surprise, right? Like, you talk to your best White House sources and they say, we think we're going to get creamed, and who are you to argue with that, right? So, yeah. No, it definitely... I think it broadly caught people by surprise.
Mm. So, what does it tell us, though, about the, and I know that you've thought about this before, I recall reading it somewhere, but what does it tell us about the media's connection with voters? That there seems to be this disconnect between media and voters, not just in the United States, certainly in Australia as well.
I think the media goes through cycles of its understanding of voters and of how to understand voters. I think my possibly controversial point of view on this is that the media made a religion of polling and sort of decided that it was sort of old-fashioned and unscientific to spend a lot of time interviewing people in diners, and that you would really just wind up reflecting back the Washington consensus and sort of pretend you'd found it in the diner. And that the thing to do was to be scientific and look at polls, which, by the way, are always quietly adjusted around the pollster's expectations of who's going to show up, which are mostly driven by who they've interacted with in diners. And I think a lot of the sort of conventional wisdom got filtered into kind of a fake science. And actually, it's pretty useful to have reporters wandering around talking to people, and that went a little bit out of fashion. And part of the reason that I think American journalists missed this cycle was that, on Twitter, you see that the person who gets the most attention is the craziest, most divisive, loudest voice. Mm. If you were even paying attention to the television advertising, which is still the main way campaigns are conducted here, you saw candidates airing ads about how they enjoy pizza, and not necessarily the most screamy and divisive things. And in the end, really, a big part of what happened was that the candidates who were perceived mostly on the right, but also on the left, as being creatures of social media driven movements lost, and candidates who are seen as being extremely mainstream figures who don't spend too much time on the internet won.
Right. Right. And so what is that telling you? What's the take home there for American journalism? Get out in the street?
Yeah, I actually think, and again, I don't think this is necessarily widely held, but like that the old fashioned reporting, which was sort of embodied and then kind of caricatured in a guy named David Broder, a Washington Post reporter, where you go and interview people out in the, you know, and bring back your best shot at understanding what's happening based on having talked to a couple hundred people, which is not scientific, that's a pretty valuable part of journalism. Mm. But also there was, that said, there was also just a lot to see in the polling that suggested this too. You know, some of these kind of Trumpy Republican candidates were underperforming in ways that were a little inexplicable. Mm. And understanding that, and, you know, and honestly, like, after every election, there's a big how the media got it wrong, but also the media got a bunch of things right. And some of this stuff they did see coming, and some people saw it coming. But there's a reporter who works with me named David Weigel, who, you know, he's just on the road 250 days a year talking to people. And you do, when you talk to him, when you read him, that really does inform, you know, a sense of what's going on that you can't get from Twitter.
Yeah. And you know, is that a general belief that's running through Semaphore for you, that it's really important to have boots on the ground so that you eyeball people, you use them almost as a bulwark against misinformation?
I think misinformation is a funny frame here, because of course, sometimes you run into people who have false beliefs about the world that inform what they're doing. So I'm not sure, I mean, which you could call misinformation, or you could call, you know, false, or whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's not like those people you talk to are often, what they'll tell you is what they saw on cable news or what they saw on the internet. So it's, I don't think it's quite that simple.
Mm. But at least you're getting the view from what, you're getting a direct view of what people actually think in the towns and villages and provinces and states across the country.
And cities. And you can be surprised. You know, people don't really reduce easily to caricature.
Yeah.
You know, I remember writing years ago about a house in Indiana that was flying a Confederate flag and had a Barack Obama lawn sign. And I remember interviewing the owners of the house, who had weird politics, right? And it's like, what's going on here? And at the time, it really felt like a total curiosity. Like, so really utterly bizarre. And, you know, and I remember the husband saying, well, you know, we want change, but I like consider myself a rebellious person, and that's what the Confederate flag means to me. Like, okay. But, you know, but in retrospect, of course, there were a lot of people who voted for Barack Obama and then for Donald Trump, which feels from a sort of, I don't know, from a lot of the kind of like analysis of politics, like a hard person for journalists to understand.
Yeah. Ben, you know, can we talk Joe Biden for a minute? Because, of course, just before the election, certainly the American media seemed to be rather underestimating his capacity to do well in this election. But in fact, not a bad result for the Democrats. Not glowing, not fantastic, but not bad either. So did they perhaps underestimate here, without wanting to get into the media has done everything wrong and underestimated and misread things again? But broadly speaking, is the American media kind of so down on Joe Biden that they might be getting him wrong?
I mean, the American people are pretty down on Joe Biden. He's not a wildly popular, beloved figure. Mm-hmm. But he's also not a hated, divisive figure. And I think that was, you know, and I think that's, that's not that sort of a boring story, right? Like, you see why people aren't writing nobody hates Joe Biden, but that does seem to, you know, nobody fears Joe Biden, but that does seem to be have been a big element of a campaign in which fear is a big motivator.
Mm. So okay, in terms of the power of Fox News, for example, which has been, you know, a reasonably big mover and shaker in the American scheme of things in relation to the dissemination of kind of far-right ideas. What do you think the results say about the hold of Fox on the American people at this point?
I mean, you know, it's a very, very divided country, right? And And the hardest core of the right and of the left spend a lot of time consuming cable television, but very small, you know, very, very small numbers of people. I think if 1% of the country watch either Fox or MSNBC on a night, that's a great night for them. It's a thing that kind of controls the political class on the right and drives a lot of the energy on the right, but it's not a mass phenomenon. The divisions in the country didn't dissipate, and Fox certainly remains by far the most powerful right-wing voice.
Mm. But when you say that the audience is quite small, I mean, the Fox News channel averaged the most election night viewers, more than double any other network or channel during prime time.
What was the number? Do you have it?
I don't actually have the exact number, but it was reported by AP News. So I was wondering what is happening there? Is it people are tuning in but ignoring what Fox is telling them, or?
Well, no, I think people who are conservative have fewer options, right? CNN, MSNBC, much of the internet are fighting for, you know, ABC, CBS, and NBC. Are more or less fighting for the same audience. And this is always, in a way, Fox's business insight, is that they have a big chunk of the audience to themselves. So I don't think that's actually that sort of emblematic of much. I don't think it represents much of a change. That's just how the country is.
Right. You're listening to Fourth Estate on the Community Radio Network. I'm joined by American journalist Ben Smith, editor-in-chief and co-founder of Semaphore, previously a media columnist for the New York Times and editor-in-chief of BuzzFeed. This week, we're talking about the United States midterm election. Okay, so let's look at Twitter for a moment, because there's been lots and lots and lots of white noise happening over there on Twitter with Elon Musk's takeover. Mm-hmm. So Trump is back, or as far as I know, he hasn't yet tweeted, but he's certainly been permitted back onto the platform. And there are folk like Marjorie Taylor Greene who are having accounts restored this week. And the platform is rejecting the previous operator's attempts to moderate and remove seditious and overly anti-democratic speech from the platform. You know, do you see that this is just Musk being naughty and kind of incendiary, or is it a real concern?
I mean, he's such an unpredictable person, and he restored Trump because there was the notion of restoring Trump narrowly won a Twitter poll.
Yeah.
I think if he'd lost the Twitter poll, he wouldn't have restored him. And that itself was a stunt to drive engagement on Twitter. And I think he is certainly operating Twitter. I mean, Twitter has sort of been operating in a way like it was a government and trying to sort of like think a lot about the public good. And he is operating Twitter like it is a business, and by the way, a business which has taken on an insane amount of debt and has gone from being a business that was sort of stumbling along to being a business that's facing a huge crisis, which is of his own making, and running it in his incredibly impulsive and unusual way. So I'm not like, you know, but it's not, but I think he's doing a lot of these things because he wants to get attention, wants more people to go on Twitter because crazy, exciting things are happening there. And he certainly also is sort of drinking from the kind of like, you know, the free speech conservative ideology, you know, which by the way says, for instance, do you want random Silicon Valley executives deciding that you're seditious? Like, that's a pretty intense power over the sort of, you know, most important public square in the world to hand over to a random employee of a private company, which is what they've done. And so I think, you know, I don't think it's like an ill. I mean, I think like a lot of people on all sides of these debates say crazy stuff all the time. But I don't think that point of view is kind of fundamentally illegitimate. You know, that elected members of the U.S. Congress, including, you know, there's 435 members of the U.S. Congress. Five of them are always the craziest five. That those people, despite the fact that they were ultimately elected by the voters in their district, should be denied access to this platform. Again, because based on the decision of a faceless executive at a private company.
Mm. Okay, so you would think that he's in your mind, has he done the right thing by reopening the platform to people who were previously considered to be, you know, not in the public interest to be there?
Honestly, I think it's totally case by case. And I disagree with some of the calls and agree with others. I mean, I agree with him. I don't know, like somebody tweeted at him kind of accurately, you know, a true move to show that you care about free speech only would be to restore Alex Jones, this kind of incredibly incendiary broadcaster who was banned from, you know, who was owes, I think, $1 billion to people he lied, whose children's deaths he lied about. And Musk just replied, no. So, I mean, and so it just seems to me he's trying to do it on a case-by-case basis, which, and not on a rule-based way, which is extremely hard to, you know, which doesn't exactly scale.
So, look, that's a really interesting take. So I'm interested to know what you think, whether you think the way he runs it actually makes a difference.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, I mean, I think it's, I don't want to make predictions about it, but it's incredibly risky. Like most social, you know, there's sort of there's a tendency of all sorts of communities, whether it's like a popular nightclub or a popular social network, to go out of fashion and close. And that's a huge risk with Twitter, with Facebook, I think right now is kind of unraveling. And it's not for one reason or the other. It's just because it's not cool to be there anymore and people would rather be somewhere else. And it's very, and these are not engineering challenges fundamentally. Their social political challenges. I think Twitter is, you know, pretty locked into a lot of journalists' lives. And so I don't really see myself leaving, but I could imagine it kind of just becoming a small bulletin board for professional journalists and government officials and everybody else leaving. And you've already seen celebrities and musicians are mostly gone. Mm. Actors, not really on Twitter anymore. Athletes are a big part of Twitter, but a lot of them have kind of quietly left. And you kind of don't notice when somebody leaves the party in a way. It's all just kind of French exits, but at some point, but that's the biggest risk, I think, is just that the people with huge followings just don't find it worthwhile. And I think journalists are pretty stuck and pretty addicted, but you know, but ultimately, like if he just jumps up and down on top of this fairly fragile platform enough, it might kind of break. And not, I don't mean technically, but just kind of socially.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think the others that have come along that look like their rivals, platforms like Mastodon, do they have any hope of competing against a platform like Twitter that's so kind of ingrained in the psyche of those at least who use it?
So I think that Mastodon is a great example of something that does not. Like, because it's basically, if you explore it, it has a lot of the same features as Twitter, but problems like moderation are much harder, and it's technically not as slick. So I don't really, it's a little hard to, I think the notion that Twitter would be replaced by an identical competitor with slightly different moderation policies does not seem likely. You know, might people want to be in smaller communities of like-minded individuals who don't disagree, you know, who, like that actually, that makes more sense to me.
Right.
Like, might people move to Discord servers where they're hanging out with people they know and agree with and not arguing against people they dislike.
Yeah.
I could see that. I think Discord, Slack, Reddit, just people moving into kind of more fragmented, smaller communities generally. I think a lot of people have in their real lives moved from public social media to text groups. Mm. I feel like everything that happens in text groups now. And that's a move in that direction.
Right. So, Ben, do you think it's going to be a huge blow to Elon Musk having restored Donald Trump to the platform that, you know, if Trump actually refuses to play in the sandpit?
No. I actually think he's, like, gotten the maximum mileage out of Trump by having a poll about whether to let him on. And then actually once he's on, he's a bit of a double-edged sword for the service because, you know, if he kind of comes – again, like – it's like Musk himself. Like right now, it's actually incredibly interesting, at least for me, to watch Musk operate this service in public and have all these crazy decisions happening as you watch. Like it's really interesting. Mm-hmm. But like, and he's incredibly smart and incredibly mercurial and unpredictable and screwing things up all over the place. But like, you know, it's like a bar. Like it's really interesting if some genius sits down at the end of the bar and is just like expounding and has all sorts of theories and is doing weird stuff, like for a while. But at some point, you'd like to hang out with your friends in the bar. And if your friends leave because this guy is dominating the conversation, you will ultimately leave. And I think there are these, it's like a social, it's a social network, right? Like it's, and so I think the kind of bigger challenges aren't really technical. They're really like, is this a place you're going to want to hang out?
Yeah. So Musk might be best off just getting out of his own way and shutting up for a little bit, at least.
I mean, who knows? Right now, he's just sort of lighting it on fire and watching it burn. It's really, and everyone is finding it highly entertaining to watch.
Okay. And look, briefly, Trump, you know, his announcement was very, very low key, was very flat. Fox News, I think, even cut away from it, although the ABC in Australia, I should tell you, actually stuck with it. Do you think he's finished? Is he yesterday's man, or are we really quite foolish to write him off?
You are quite foolish to write him off.
Yeah.
I would say he's the very popular and divisive former president who, I agree, like doesn't seem to have caught fire and his heart doesn't seem to be into it, but I suspect he'll manage to summit. He's also, you know, quite a bit older than he was when he last ran, mm-hmm. 8 years, long time. But I think he'll. I suspect he will ultimately summon the energy.
And if he is the Republicans' nominee, how should the media treat and cover him this time? And how will Semaphore cover him?
I don't quite understand the question.
If he's the Republican nominee, how do you think the media should... there was criticism of the way the media covered him the first time around in 2016, that it was kind of...
Yeah, I think the media gave him a sort of open platform and treated him sometimes as an entertainer who couldn't win. But I also am a little tired of the notion that that he's fundamentally the fault of the media. Like at this point, you know, I think most American voters are pretty familiar with who he is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them really like him, like a majority of Republicans. I don't think that's because of the media coverage. Like, I think that's because they like him.
So how will you cover him?
I mean, we've been covering it very aggressively. So we broke the story today about how afraid Republicans are that he will mount a third party bid. I mean, I we will certainly not repeat lies verbatim. Nobody should. But I think we'll cover him like we will, you know, we cover any other story.
I have to say I'm quite enjoying Semaphore. So congratulations on the effort. I know it's been a long time in the making. But you'd previously told Vanity Fair that one of the aims of Semaphore was to disrupt partisan divides and find a global audience. How are you getting people out of their silos? Are you getting people out of their silos?
You know, I think we have a lot to work on. I would love your listeners' feedback. But what we're really trying to do is cover the news in a way that acknowledges that there's room for legitimate disagreement if you can get to a place where there are shared facts. And I think if you look at our articles, if you look at our newsletters, you'll see elements that are really saying, you know, here's my, and we're trying to be really transparent. Like I reported this story, here's what I think it means, but I could be wrong. And here's somebody else's analysis. And we're trying to be, you know, to signal and really live a kind of openness to disagreement that I think is, that social media really discourages, but I think people are really hungry for.
And what's the feedback been like? Are your audience getting back to you and telling you that they're liking this or not liking this?
Everyone loves it. it's been really positive. I mean, I think we were really scared, you know, you're always nervous putting a new thing out in the public. And I think we found that people are really responding to that element in particular, that sense, which, you know, we don't always get exactly right. But that sense that we're trying to give you the facts, be transparent about what we think about them, but also be like humble about how much we know and how often we're right.
Mm. It's interesting that there have been, you know, so many startups in the media world. Some have lasted the distance and others have toppled. You, of course, were at BuzzFeed, which was one of the more infamous and famous startups in the world. What did you learn there that you're bringing to Semaphore that's making a difference, do you think?
I mean, I think I learned all sorts of things. I was there for 8 years and certainly learned, you know, the extent to which great quality news, great scoops can kind of fight their way into the conversation if they're from an outlet you've never heard of before. You know, also certainly learned a lot about remaining disciplined about spending money in a startup, I would say. And we're trying to be really careful and really, you know, and really build a bit. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I learned was about, you know, BuzzFeed was this incredible entertainment company that we kind of grafted a news organization onto, and that worked for a while. And then the environment changed and the audience wanted those things to be more separate after 2016. And we, you know, made a bunch of mistakes and also struggled to adjust. I think here, you know, we have a small team. We're very, very focused on news. We're a news company. That's totally our DNA. Our business is entirely built around quality news. And that's a big difference and something I'm really enjoying.
I mean, obviously, it's very difficult for startups, particularly in the digital age, to kind of balance out tech and content. And I mean, I have heard it written by many a journalism scholar that it's important to not only keep lean, but keep an eye on what you're providing. That is, that you're providing actual news content and you're not a tech company with all the kind of different bells and whistles that make it lovely for people to look at. Although I have to say, I think your site is actually quite attractive. But
thank you. A lot of people really like it and some people really hate it. And I do think that's because we've invested a lot in design and taken a risk, you know?
Yeah.
So
in terms of balancing out the tech and the content, I mean, you know, what's the belief at Semaphore at the moment? Is all of your effort, all the money going into content, or is there a balancing act happening here?
You know, we're a news company. We're not a tech company, and we're very clear-eyed about that. But that said, we have great technologists, a great CTO who's one of the, named Mark Wilkie, who's one of the who built a lot of internet media. He worked on early Gawker, early HuffPost, was BuzzFeed CTO, and really the site has been incredibly stable and fast in a way that is not true of startups I've been at before. And we have a great product lead who came from Wirecutter. So I think we are a news company, but we really believe in quality tech and product.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, and also, but in terms of your core journalistic belief, it's in nonpartisanship, right? Am I right in summarizing it that way?
We certainly don't want to be partisan, but I think but I also think we're not trying to sort of position ourselves entirely around a partisan environment. Like, we're just trying to be honest about what we think and where there's room for disagreement around the news.
Mm. And for those who don't know, what does Semaphore mean?
It's an old word that refers to an old Greek word that refers to the bearer of a signal. And what we really loved about it is it's the same versions of it are the same word in, you know, 50 or 60 languages around the world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So before I let you go, I just want to swing back, if I might, to this question of Donald Trump in terms of the possibility of him running. Do you seriously entertain the possibility? I can understand how people might think that the Republicans might opt for him to be their candidate. Do you seriously entertain the possibility that the American people, divided as your country is at the moment, might go that way again?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I think he won before, he could win again. I don't see why not. And I definitely have learned to not predict the outcomes of U.S. elections. But I feel like that was my big personal lesson from 2016.
Ben, thank you very, very much for talking to us, and we hope to have you on the show again sometime.
Great. It's really nice to talk to you.
And thank you for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation, to whom we offer our thanks for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so that you can hear us talk about media, politics and everything in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is FourthEstateAU. And thanks to my producer, Marlene Even, and executive producer, Anthony Dockrell. I'm Monica Attard. Thank you for listening.